Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 10K Collective podcast, the place to be for six, seven and eight figure Amazon sellers. Delighted today to introduce a very different guest with a very big vision. That's Konark Ogra of Rural Handmade. Rural Handmade is there to increase shared prosperity across the entire globe by bringing makers closer to the market. So that's quite the vision. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael, for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I spoke to you at a conference recently. I was really struck by your vision and your enthusiasm for your vision. It's quite different. And I think it's got a long-term potential, which I always like. We always like on the 10K Collective. So first of all, handmade or rural handmade goods, how on earth does that work for Amazon sellers? And what is this all about?
Yeah, so briefly, what this business is about, it's about trying to connect the rural artisanal communities, which actually live across the world, to the global consumer market. And we do this with the help of data and design. So that's what the business is all about. How does it benefit Amazon sellers? Well, you know, ever so increasingly, we keep hearing about how do you build a brand? How do you build a defensible brand? How do you build a brand with impact? And all these three things are deeply knitted into the DNA of Rural Handmade. We essentially help entrepreneurs realize their dreams and convert their ideas into an actual product. And this basically happens in a very fast and frugal manner for the system that we have adopted in the business that we run.
Nice. Okay, that's a great summary of what you do. So connecting rural handmakers with global markets, and the entrepreneurs are part of that chain, I guess, adding value with their ideas, their initiative, their capital, and that sort of thing. You were mentioning to me when we were talking about this before that sustainability is a big piece. And obviously, that's a real buzzword. So tell me a bit more about that. How does that tie in with this?
Absolutely. So let's look at the big problem that all of us as consumers face, you know, living in the world we live in right now, which is sustainability. You know, people do talk about how do we get rid of plastic? How do we actually purchase a more informed decision that we take to buy new things? And how can we, you know, kind of optimize our consumption? And so this one problem that everybody faces is that I do want to be sustainable. I do not want to buy mass-produced products. And I also want to make sure that I actually have an impact with my buying decisions. But the only problem is that sustainability is expensive. It actually is a luxury to have a sustainable lifestyle. On the other hand, what we have is we have these millions and millions of makers across the developing countries who are very skilled craftspersons, and they've been preaching sustainability for many hundreds and thousands of years. So the only problem they have now is that they lack two specific things, which is number one, they lack design excellence, which means they're making wrong designs or they're making, they're overproducing designs that not many need. And number two is that they lack the reach to the global consumer market. Because if you live in a remote area, for you to actually make a business case by shipping your product to the US or to the Western European region does not make a business case. So what we are saying essentially is there is an inversion of huge demand of sustainable products and a potential supply opportunity with the help of these millions and millions of makers across the world. And so all we're trying to do is just connect these two dots.
Amazing. Right. It's fantastic. So you're a middle ground, I guess, like a lot of marketplaces of some kind or other, that you're connecting two sides of an equation. What I like about your vision is the sustainability piece, which is not only feels better to be involved with, but I think is the big, big trend. I was going to say for the new millennium, that's a very outdated phrase now, but for the next, say, 10, 20, 50 years or more, because Amazon's managed to connect the Chinese factories who are famously great at whacking out things in plastic by the tens of thousands. So they've connected Western consumers essentially to China. So you're offering to do the same with a rather more cuddly and sustainable people. So that's lovely. What's the sort of more business upside for resellers, retailers? What's the business case for doing this?
Well, the business case is actually pretty straightforward. So number one is that we don't typically work like how you would do it in Alibaba. So if you want to build a brand or build a product, you go on Alibaba and you search for the product. Now, essentially, if you already see the product on Alibaba, it basically means that this product already exists. So you're not trying to actually build a new product, but you're actually trying to make slight variations to existing ones, which in the long term possibly is not going to benefit you as much. Now, what we do is we talk to entrepreneurs on a one-to-one basis, understand what their needs are, exact design requirements that they have, the kind of raw materials they want to use to make the product. And then we commission this design into a product in a low-cost, make-to-order model. So entrepreneurs can actually literally start from a scratch and draft their ideas in a piece of paper with few sketches. And we can then, with the help of the design team we have internally, commission this design into, you know, whatever product that would eventually come out.
Amazing. And I really, really like this for several reasons. First of all, as you said, Alibaba. I mean, it's on Alibaba, it's on Amazon, pretty much. So it's getting very, very difficult. Pure private label as such, I think, is dying off, which is understandable. But then you've got to look at, okay, how do I affordably find a way to get unique designs? We've already had Ryan Chaffett come on to talk about creating custom designs in China, which is very important for certain types of products. But this is another alternative route to getting something that is unique, which I think is the key thing. And I really like the fact as well that you have an in-house design team, because the idea of industrial design for most of us is pretty daunting. I certainly have no feel for that. And hiring a designer in the West, while you know, it can be very effective in terms of the quality, can quickly become pretty expensive. So tell us a bit more about I'm going to do a bigger picture thing and come to this later on, but I can't resist the question of how do I make money, which I think any real entrepreneur is going to have at the top of their mind. How does that actual process work? Talk us through that a little bit more in detail.
Absolutely. So it's a very simple process. What we have is, if you're an entrepreneur and you've had a deep passion about, making a product or building a brand around the product, what you would do essentially is identify the niche you want to specialize in. So let's pick up the case of leather, just to give an example. You have this design, which I think fits in very well with these avid travelers, and it can do multiple things to this product. You can put your passports and your files and your laptops, and you know this design is going to sell very well. Now, what do you do after this? Is you actually come to us and share your ideas. We sign an NDA, which is a non-disclosure agreement, in terms of we will not be sharing this outside between you and me. And it's private property of you, because you hold all the IPs and stuff. Now, this design then goes to our design team, where they actually break it down in a very simplistic manner. So the makers who eventually will be looking at the design can understand what this product is all about. So all the dimensions would be formalized, all the angles, you know, what kind of materials we will be using, and stuff like that. And now these makers then start making the first product, which is the prototype. Now, this prototype essentially is the benchmark product that we would be making. So once we make the prototype, it gets shipped to the entrepreneur. He approves it, or he probably gives us further modifications. And then we keep retreating it till we actually finalize on the product. Once the product is finalized, we then start making multiple orders. It can be in the series of hundreds and 500s and 700 and 1,000 and 2,000, depending on how the sales picks up for the entrepreneurs. And so simply put, if I simply put this, it's a very fast and frugal process. You bring an idea to us. We have the design team, but it transforms the idea into an actual image. It can be an AutoCAD image or an Adobe image, and then the makers make it. And then it gets shipped to you or to Amazon and wherever you want it to be sent.
Nice. Okay. Well, I mean, what I'm really liking about this, and I have to, you know, give it a try for myself, but is that it feels a bit less daunting than the process of manufacturing, because obviously that's very led by mechanical thinking, mechanical processes, which if you've got an engineering or very analytical background, works well. And a lot of the people I know who are doing best in the Amazon space have got that kind of brain and that kind of background. But for a lot of people who are newer to the space, I think the idea of very simple design and simple processes is probably something that's easier to grasp and get your head around and get right. Because obviously when you mass produce a plastic widget, if you've got something slightly wrong that you need a chemical lab to test, that's quite a tricky thing to get right, right? So is that been your experience, that sort of new people are trying this out, or is it very established entrepreneurs who have been the people that have tended to use this process so far?
Well, I think the funny thing is, just to add to the previous conversation, that the problem with mass-produced products is that obviously the scope of you making a mistakes is minimal, because you've got to stop the factory setup, you've got to change the dye. To make a new dye would possibly cost you 5, 10, 15, 20 grand. But if you actually look at the handmade industry, because the prime focus is hands and basic tools, so you can make mistakes and it'll still not cost you a lot. So that's the key. That's the key difference between how does handmade have the ability to actually experiment to a level that you could never imagine before. And still, the cost of a mistake is probably marginal as compared to a cost that you would incur if you probably go to China or all these mass manufacturing companies. And so that's one big advantage we have in terms of the innovation and the creativity we can put in place with the handmade industry.
Yeah, I really like that. So in other words, the cost of innovation is very, very low, whereas normally with a manufactured type product, I said normally, I guess what I'm used to is that you put batch number one out into the market, maybe it's a few hundred. If you're just starting out testing it, you get some feedback, you can go back and do batch number two, you can innovate, but then you've got 1,000 products out there that may have some dreadful hidden flaw that you didn't catch at your pre-shipment inspection. So I really like the fact that you can, it's just on a human scale, I guess, which I don't guess for me, I mean, I'd never thought of it this way, but I have a sort of hand-making background in the sense that I hand-make music at a piano or, used to be with conducting back in the day. And I suppose that for me, it feels kind of the right thing, because the idea of mass producing feels a bit scary, that it's a bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, if you know that tradition, that, basically you wave your magic wand and stuff happens very quickly, which is great, but then it's all out of control as well. So I really like that. And maybe other people resonate with that as well. So let me flip that on its head then, because obviously the point of having machines and manufacturing type processes that are very rigid is that you get very consistent quality. Now, obviously, if it's consistently bad, that's very bad. But if it's consistent, if it's set up well and it's consistently good quality, then you can see why a machine is going to generally produce exactly the same widget each time. How do you account for variability with handmade things? How do you reduce variability and how do you sort of handle that situation?
That's a really good question. I actually get asked this a lot of times, and how do we ensure this? And the simple answer is we have standard operating procedures, and these are not just our procedures, but these are industry standards, and there are like guidelines on what the tolerance could be, what the standard deviation would be. And for us, the most important thing is to convey the message to the makers that you have to maintain the quality that the entrepreneurs are demanding for. And because it is handmade, it doesn't mean that we will have huge variations in production. It just basically means that there will be slight variations, and which actually makes it even unique in every possible sense. And also keeping in mind that handmade products are essentially products that you buy as an individual or you want to gift it to somebody. These are not products that get into a manufacturing unit where a tolerance of 5% can make or break things. So it's a mix and match of both, It's made by hand. Its uniqueness is the USP. The sustainability is the USP. At the same time, we have these industry practices that we follow deeply inside the company, in which the variations are minimum, as minimum as possible.
Makes total sense. Yeah, it's not going to be an industrial context. It does make sense. I mean, if you give somebody a leather handmade bag for putting their passport and laptop in when they're going globetrotting, then yeah, it doesn't really matter if the dimensions are out by a few millimeters or something here, there, because it's not going to blow up a machine. So that's a very good point. And yeah, and the fact that it's unique and that's a USP is a very good point. So yeah, interesting. Yeah. And I guess like anything else, it comes down to not the discipline of machines, but the discipline of communication, right? And having some kind of sets and balances. So tell me about that. Obviously, in any system, you've got to have quality control processes.
obviously having a clear SOP or clear sets of regulations, guidelines, acceptable quality limits, etc., is up front is good. So how do you consistently check that those are being followed and deal with it if it isn't?
Right. So what we have in a process is we have a few team members who are a part of the quality control. So starting off with somebody called as a rural handmade champion, who actually is a lead artisan whose responsibilities are a little bit different than just, you know, making sure the products are made, but also to look at the quality aspect of it. At the end of the cycle of production, we have a third-party contractor. For example, you know, companies like Intertech and quality control companies that would actually go and have a look at the quality and see if all the QC you know, points are checked, if all the deliverables are made according to the SOPs that were defined. And hence, we're able to keep this fine balance of quality and also, you know, make sure the quantity is there as well. So it's basically, you know, people in the team that help us, you know, manage the total quality and keep the variations as minimum as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in other words, you have an internal quality control sort of lead person, and then you have external checks as well. So in the end, I guess it comes down to a lot of things, which is the quality of the artisans you pick, right? I'm just thinking about orchestras. I mean, if I can have all the processes in the world, but if I pick people with bad training or a bad attitude, it's going to be a bad result. Whereas I guess the art is in picking good people and getting rid of people who prove unreliable over time, right? So I suppose in the end, that's probably how it works. So tell me a little bit more about that side of things. So how do you pick which artisans to work with and which ones to stop working with?
That's a very good point you made. So just to give you a small brief about the handmade industry, which will eventually answer the question we have. So handmade industry is the second largest employer in the world, which basically means a lot of people in the developing nations, if they're not doing agriculture in the rural areas, they actually do handmade stuff. Now, a lot of governments have this deep understanding that this is this huge human capital that hasn't been tapped properly. And so they're trying to promote and teach them new skills and to kind of semi-mechanize their making processes. And they have, all of them have actually done something called as a soft randomized control trial, in which what they've done is they've understood that everybody in every cluster and every community will have a different skill as far as the handmade industry is concerned. And they've actually been able to identify the right set of partners and right set of communities which have the potential to go outside their cluster, outside their region, outside the countries. So what we do is we have a two-way process. We partner with the local government and we have the access of the database of all the makers they have across the remotest of the places or in smaller villages or towns. And then we work with them on a very small order. So we probably will get them a prototype to be made. And then we look at how well do they adhere to the rural handmade principles and guidelines. And if they actually match to the expectations that we have, they become a part of the ecosystem we have. And so this is like an ongoing process. Now, the other thing we do is we obviously go out and our local community partners and employees reach out to these different regions and identify these communities which possibly are not in touch with the governments. And then with the help of a low-cost technology device, which is a mobile phone and cheap internet, we remain in touch with them. And we transfer this knowledge of new designs and new ideas and quickly, you know, work on the prototype part of it. So it's a two-way strategy. So one is partnership with the governments, which have the database. And the second is, you know, using technology, you know, basic ICT, you know, internet and mobile phones and WhatsApp to reach out and build the community at our end.
Right, makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that I've been reading recently in The Economist is where I generally get my news from. I try and avoid newspapers because they just go on about things that depress me about that. The Economist is quite a broad view, global view, and it's amazing how much development's been going on in rural India specifically in the last sort of few years. Apparently that it's gone from a totally non-connected to traditional bank accounts to suddenly everyone's using WhatsApp. So very interesting, fast-moving development there. So look, one question I haven't asked you is to give a bit of background about yourself. Obviously, you've got a very structured approach to these things, which is highly reassuring for those of us who've dealt with sort of random variability in our sourcing in the past. So tell us a bit more about your personal background, Kanak.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny enough, actually, I was not doing any of this before. So I actually, I'm an engineer with qualification, and I used to work as a technology consultant for a very large organization. And our clients and my jobs were located in the Middle East and North Africa. Then I went to the US. I was continuing a research project there. And basically what happened was it just struck me that, you know, why is there poverty and why do, you know, very skilled people have issues in 2019. You know, I mean, it's very seamless now reaching out to the market. And I wanted to do something different, which can actually create a massive impact to the society we live in. And then I looked at this industry, which doesn't really get talked about. You know, right now, I think the focus with most governments across the developing nations is agriculture. And so agri-tech is pretty big. But handmade, you know, believe it or not, it's a very interesting industry. It's a very creative industry. The only problem with these people is what we've identified is the lack of innovation. And we could just see a clear business case. You know, people love handmade. People love sustainability. These guys deliver exactly, or they have the potential to deliver exactly what they need. And so we saw this is a brilliant business case. And this is not just a profit business, because this is profit for the purpose kind of a business. And our development outcomes is clearly about engagement. You know, how many people can we get into the community? How many people can we give employment to? How many people can we, make a part of this inclusive global market? And then all this basically drove me to do this full time now. And you know, my biggest drive is that in this about 18 months, we've been able to impact 300 lives, you know, 300 people, and then they had their families of probably four or five each. So that's a big number. And we haven't even just started. You know, our appetite is massive. And all this put together was clearly the reason why we thought we could actually, you know, disrupt the way the handmade industry exists and the future of handmade industry as well.
Wow. So that's quite the vision. As I said, I warned people when you're starting off that you have this very, very big vision. But I mean, what you're seeing is that, as you said, there's a solid business case, which I think what is nice about that is that there's just huge potential for several years to decades, which is that there's an untapped source of supply, and then there's massive demand. And as you were saying, that sustainability is the huge thing, and that goes hand in hand, no pun intended, with handmade stuff. So amazing stuff. Let's talk about ICT. You just mentioned the ICT penetration in the areas where rural handmade stuff is made is helping. Tell us a bit more about that side of things, because I know it's developing fast.
Yeah, so I'll just give you a brief, idea. So United Nations came with a report last year in which they, I think, said that by 2023, all 8 billion people on Earth will be connected to the internet. Now, that's very surprising, because I think a lot of governments have not been able to provide electricity to everybody, but internet is going to be there everywhere, and so is the low-cost mobile device. Now, ICT penetration in Africa and in Southeast Asia is in triple and four digits, which basically means there's this massive, massive number of people joining internet and becoming a part of, you know, the global internet world, which basically makes a very strong case for our business, because our business, the core of the business is how do we get to communities and how do we transfer knowledge? And, you know, just stuff like WhatsApp really helps us do that. You know, we've actually connected to the places where they don't have electricity for more than 3 hours a day. But they receive our, you know, messages, they receive our design ideas, they help us make the prototype and stuff like that. And we think that there's a much bigger kind of an opportunity in terms of, you know, how do we actually develop and promote this untapped human capital, which essentially does not exist right now in the market.
Okay. So one obvious question that I get, for example, that I suppose I'm looking for the problems in supply chains, having had experience like anyone who sold online for more than 5 minutes, that when you say places only have electricity 3 hours a day and they can manage to connect with you, that's kind of great. To flip it on its head, that sounds like a bit of a risk to my supply chain. So I know that even if, for example, I've got a meeting at midday today with somebody over in the Philippines, and this time of year when they have monsoons, half the time their internet is down and they can't get online. So how do you deal with that sort of potentially inconsistent ability to contact based on the infrastructure, for example, electricity generation, if that goes out for several days or something like that?
Well, I think it's a good point you made. I think what we've basically done is we've been able to build the tribe. And tribe is not necessarily just relying on technology, but it's also a lot of people. So what we do is we try to find this one rural handmade cluster champion or domain champion or like a subject matter expert who's educated, understands what we're trying to do, and then he helps us convey the message and helps us with the entire process of, you know, making the things. Now, electricity, generally speaking, isn't really needed for all the handmade practices. For example, if you probably do wood, just to clean the wood and shape it up, you need grinders that needs electricity. But for example, leather doesn't necessarily need a lot of electricity. It's just basic tools, hands, and leather, and you can make whatever you want to make. So what we've seen is that it obviously does not, you know, hamper as much. But having said that, I was just giving you an extreme case of how well internet has been able to penetrate across the world. We don't necessarily work with communities that don't have the ability to perform at the stage we are in right now. But as we kind of move forward, we will try to be more inclusive and get, you know, some of the mediocre, you know, level artisans to understand the bigger picture and then helping them grow from where they stand, which is basically in the DNA of Rural Handmade. We want to make this not just a few hundred member company, but we wanted to make this a community of makers who are skilled and have the right attitude to understand and make things that are more relevant for everybody, basically.
So in the end, you're not just relying on the technology to communicate, but you got to find local leaders who are going to keep the leadership and the vision going, whether or not the electricity happens to be working. And as you said, a lot of the time that it's not so critical for handmade goods. So yeah, I guess it comes down to trying to marry up the issues and opportunities they have with their abilities as well. So that's quite an interesting process to try and manage, though, if you suddenly have electricity going out in a village. But I guess maybe it's something I'm a bit too paranoid about here. But and in practice, I guess they've been working around this for a long time, right? They know how to handle this. Have you found that it's actually had any particular impact, or is this just something that I'm worrying about needlessly here?
No, I mean, so I think just the fact that, because I think we probably understand the system and the way this works better than if you've probably never been to India, or if you don't understand how it works in China or Indonesia. But I think the bigger factor is that it's a genuine problem. There are issues. I'm not saying there are no issues. But at the end of the day, we're trying to, you know, have a very strong story. And you as a seller can leverage on the way, you know, your purchasing decisions have transformed lives. And I think that probably is one of the biggest USPs you would have as a seller. And, you know, we in the future want to, you know, build a relationship between you and the makers and then kind of, you know, move on to different entrepreneurs. So it's all about, you know, how do we connect human lives to each other and make this world a much better place? It does sound quite visionary and difficult, but trust me, it is not. Because we have seen personally, you know, big companies like TK Maxx and Walmart and John Lewis, a lot of them, you know, genuinely work with, you know, smaller communities. IKEA does it all the time as well. And if they can do it at such a high scale, I'm very sure we can do it at the level of, you know, Amazon sellers as well.
Absolutely. Listen, I feel a bit of a sort of a chill for being so sort of questioning of something that's very visionary. But I like what you're saying. I'm actually, it is scalable. It is something that people are doing. And I guess I'm trying to sort of put the awkward questions that somebody listening will that has been around the block, you know, has been quite experienced with supply chain issues. But as you say, I mean, the main thing is that from the marketing perspective, I mean, without, never mind actually being a nice person and helping people, which is also a good thing to be, but from the marketing perspective, it's got a very clear USP and selling point. And that's the main thing that's going to outweigh any little sort of wobbles. Besides which, the truth is that if you've got a relationship with the Chinese factory you for more than 5 minutes, you'll know that there's all sorts of issues that come up there as well. So it's not like any supply chain is going to be free of issues. So they just happen to be somewhat different in say, rural India to what they would be in Shenzhen or something like that, right?
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, look, that's amazing stuff. I think in the next episode, then, we're going to talk about how to make money now and get a bit more into more actionable steps. But that's a fantastic introduction to Rural Handmade stuff. So thank you.
No problem. The pleasure is all mine.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million Mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that Mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for Mother, P for Peter, M for Mother. Thanks for listening.